What's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of Syracuse Sports. My name is Brent Axe. I will be your maitre d' for the evening, and we've got a great show lined up for you today. You see this book over my shoulder if you're watching on YouTube. It's called Pipeline to the Pros. My friend Danny Parkins wrote this book. It is excellent. We will discuss it and much more from Danny, a former radio talk show host here in Syracuse, a Syracuse alum, now kicking some major butt in Chicago as one of the best sports talk show hosts in the country, and now best-selling author as I speak. This is the number one sports book on Amazon. So we're going to talk to Danny about that, and he's got some interesting stories about his time here in Syracuse. Before I give you a couple quick takes before that, let me remind you that our Syracuse sports insiders have such a big voice in this show. Your thoughts, your opinions, your questions. You guys have been suggesting topics for me. Hey, Brent, what are you going to do when spring football practice is over and things start to maybe slow down a little bit? You're thinking about Uncle Brent, and I appreciate that. And we are stacking up some fun things to discuss in the summer months, and it's all thanks to you guys. So please, if you haven't, give it a shot. All you have to do, text the word orange to 315-847-3895. It's right there on your screen if you're watching on YouTube. You can try it free for 2 weeks. And what happens is you get direct text message access to me, cut through the clutter of social media. This is one of the great things that I've heard from people, in that the text service cuts out the clutter. You don't have to search through Twitter and social media for all this stuff and happen to come upon something. When we have breaking news, you get it. When we have insight, analysis, opinion, spring practice reports, transfer portal news in basketball and in football, that portal is open until the end of the month. Lacrosse is coming down the home stretch here. Whatever else comes up, I just have something on my mind I want to ask you about. My friend Chris Carlson was speaking the other day to a Syracuse University executive about the reseating at the JMA Wireless Dome and what's going on there. I said, hey, what kind of questions do you guys have? We fed it to Chris. So being a Syracuse Sports Insider has so many great benefits. As mentioned, you can try it free for 2 weeks, and then it's just $3.99 a month after that, less than a buck a week. So please come on board. We're going to be doing all kinds of pods where you guys are going to have a big voice in that, and have had a big voice in along the way here. So we would love for you to become a Syracuse Sports Insider today. A couple of things on my mind before we get to my friend Danny Parkins. And that is, to start with, the Syracuse women's lacrosse team has got to beat Boston College. So the women head to Boston College on Thursday. This is a team that has won 9 straight games. This is a team, if I could steal a line from the great movie Major League, the only thing they have left to do is win the whole bleeping thing. Syracuse women's lacrosse has been very successful under Kayla Traynor, and successful before that under Gary Gate. Just this past season, this team won its first outright ACC title. But there's one thing missing, and that's the national championship. They have done pretty much everything else you can do in the sport, and that is a credit to their success, that the only thing missing is that big trophy on the shelf, because they've checked pretty much every other box that you could have here. But in order to win the national championship, they have got to get this monkey off their back. That is Boston College. The Eagles have beaten Syracuse in 4 straight games. Now, let's look at this here. The last time Syracuse beat Boston College on the road was in 2014. You know who had a game-high 5 points in that game? That would be Kayla Traynor, who's now the head coach of the Orange. 2021 National Championship game, Kayla Traynor, an assistant coach at Boston College. That starts a 4-game winning streak for Boston College over Syracuse. Traynor's 45-12 overall at Syracuse, a spectacular record. 3 of those losses are to Boston College, right? In its last 4 games against BC, Syracuse has 3 losses by 2 goals or less. They have been so darn close to beating this team. And so here's the thing. Syracuse can beat the best team in women's college lacrosse. That's Northwestern, because I've seen them beat Northwestern in recent years. I've seen them play close against Northwestern in recent years. Northwestern blew them out in a recent tournament, but Syracuse has proven that not only they can hang with, but beat the best team in the country. But they cannot beat their nemesis in the ACC, and they have just as good a shot in this one as they do in any of those other games that I mentioned. But there's something about when Syracuse and Boston College get together that you just throw the numbers out. And look, the numbers right now, Draw controls are big for Syracuse. Kate Mishewski is one of the best in the country. Delaney Switzer, her save percentage has dropped off a little bit in goals. She was at 50% last year. She was one of the best players in the country. She's at 41% this year. So not having the year she did a year ago, but still has proven she can step up big in any time and at any time in any big game. BC's goalie, Shea Dolce, ACC Freshman of the Year last year. She's going to be tough to beat. I can go through all the names here, all the scoring for Syracuse. Emma Tyrell and Olivia Adamson and Peyton Raleigh and speedsters Maddie Baxter and Natalie Smith and Olivia Adamson and all the names that pop. Emma Ward, of course, has to be put into that conversation. Syracuse has the offensive firepower. They have the draw controls. They have the defense. They have the goaltender to make a run all the way. But they've got to beat Boston College in order to prove that they can make that run. They've got an ACC title in hand. They've got a 9-game winning streak in hand. But guess what? They had a 15-game winning streak, the top spot in the country, and a team that looked like with Megan Tyrell, with Meg Carney, and some players that have moved on from Syracuse. Go back a couple of years ago with Emily Harris-Chuck on board. These are some of the best players in program history, and they just haven't been able to get over that hump and win the national championship. If this is going to be the team to do it, they've got to beat Boston College in Chestnut Hill on Thursday night. The other thing on my mind is De'Asia Fair. De'Asia Fair drafted 16th in the WNBA draft, the highest rated WNBA draft ever, with over 2.5 million viewers. And of course, Caitlin Clark was a big part of that, but couldn't have had a bigger stage for De'Asia Fair to, in essence, start her WNBA career. She is now, along with two other players in the WNBA, Olivia Apupa from Minnesota and Crystal Dangerfield from Dallas, the shortest player in the league. And look, I'm not going to give you a lot of cliches here about, but you can't measure her heart and all those things. At the pro game, measurables matter. And being the shortest player in the WNBA is going to be yet another challenge for De'Asia Fair to overcome. Here's where she has a major advantage to do that. By going to the back-to-back defending champions, Las Vegas, the Aces. There's not a lot of pressure on De'Asia Fair. Think of Indiana, the top pick. Caitlin Clark has to come in and lead from the get-go and be the star in a league full of the best players in the world, and a lot of those great players just chomping at the bit to take on Caitlin Clark, given the success that she has had and what she has brought to the sport, right? De'Asia's the 16th pick. She's coming into an established championship team. She's not going to be expected to lead. But the biggest advantage in talking about the shortest player in the WNBA now is her coach, Becky Hammon. Becky Hammon is one of the best basketball coaches on planet Earth, men, women, and anything else you want to mention. She was also a shorter player that overcame a lot of odds. She's one of the smartest coaches in the league. The Becky Hammon Award in college basketball, which De'Asia Fair was nominated for 3 times as the best point guard in the game. There is so much involved in being drafted, if that's basketball, football, whatever the sport may be, baseball, where it's just darn luck. What kind of organization are you going to? What kind of coach do you have? Who's going to put you in the best position to be successful? And in that case, De'Asia Fair could not have gone to a better team and could not have gone to a better coach. It was mentioned, Holly Rowe brought this up on the ESPN broadcast. She was talking to Becky Hammon before the draft, and De'Asia Fair's name came up and said, how would you feel if De'Asia fell to the Aces at the 16th pick? And Becky Hammon responded that, I can't remember what the exact, I don't want to misquote her here, but it was basically like, we would jump on that pick. Well, they did jump on that pick. And De'Asia is now in Las Vegas and could not have a better opportunity, could not have a better coach to continue to prove people wrong. Measurables matter at the pro level, but it's a heck of a story that is starting to be written. And there is not a person that has watched Syracuse basketball in the last 3.5 years that is not rooting for De'Asia Fair to go out there and have that kind of success. And what a story it would be. Speaking of success stories in basketball, the path from Division III to the NBA, some of the biggest names in the history of the sport started at Division III, started at schools that are not too far from where I sit right now, like Brockport and Nazareth. Division III schools surround me everywhere here in Central New York. My friend Danny Parkins and his friend Ben Kaplan wrote a great book about it. It's called Pipeline to the Pros. We are going to discuss that. Danny is in Chicago. A little NFL draft talk with why the Chicago Bears are so locked in on Caleb Williams. And Danny's got some good stories from our time together here in Syracuse and his time here in Syracuse as well as a noted Syracuse alum. So let's get to it. My friend Danny Parkins here on Syracuse Sports. So Danny, when you do these kind of things, a standard question is, why did you write this book? Well, I know why you wrote this book, and we're going to get into that. I'm more interested in how you wrote this book. You do a four-hour radio show in Chicago, and I know the prep monster that you are and the work that goes into that alone. You have two young kids. Happy birthday to Eli, by the way, as we record this. And I know that you had some very personal things that you went through with your father and your brother in recent years. So how does throwing a book and writing a book and the process into that happen, given all that's going on in your life?
I sometimes try to pack in 25 hours into a 24-hour day. That definitely has been something I've been accused of before. It should be noted, I have a co-author on the project, Ben Kaplan and Danny Parkins, so there's some division of labor that has happened along the way. He has a full-time job. He has three kids. I have a full-time job. I have two kids. As you mentioned, my dad was sick with dementia. My brother had been diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. Ben's dad got sick with a rare form of cancer and passed away before this publication. So the book is dedicated to all three people who we lost along the way. And I'm donating a portion of every book sold to brain cancer research in honor of my brother. I mean, the book took like 3 years, you know? So this was not like you have to have it out by this time type of thing. We knew that we weren't exactly competing with anyone else on the pipeline of former Division III players who had made it to the NBA. You know, it's a niche story that we think tells some pretty macro lessons about the value of a liberal arts education, management, networking, a diverse education, the history of the NBA, best practices for hiring. So, I mean, I think it applies to a lot of broader themes, but we also knew that we weren't exactly like, we have to be first to market with this idea because no one else was competing with us. So we did about a little over 800 hours of research. We did over 100 interviews. The book is very, very thorough, but we also took our time on it.
I'm interested in that process. How did you and Ben kind of split it up? Who does what? Do you have like a Google Doc going on who's writing what? Take me into your process. And you mentioned it's a 3-year process to do this and getting this project completed.
Yeah. So Ben played Division III basketball. So he called me and said, I have an idea to run by you. Did you know that 12 of the 30 teams at the time, either their head coach or their top basketball decision maker, president of basketball operations or GM, had played D3 ball? And I said, no, I had no idea. He's like, yeah, you could make the argument that statistically you're just as likely to have one of those positions if you played D3 ball or you played Division I ball. I'm like, wow, that blew my mind. I had no idea. I've always been attracted to the idea of networks. You go to Syracuse, they pitch you on the broadcasting network. And he's like, I think there's a book here, but no one will buy a book from a data analyst who has no media profile on this subject matter. And I'm like, well, I have a decent media profile. And so we teamed up on that and worked on the proposal together. And the interviews and the promotion and that part of thing was me. More of the research was him. We collaborated. He's an excellent writer. There were tons of shared Google Docs. So it's like, okay, I've got Brad Stevens, you know, locked up for an interview in a week. And then he would give me a Google Doc of all of the background research on Brad Stevens. And then we would formulate the questions together, but I would do the interviews because I have experience interviewing people. People were more likely to agree to an interview with, I host the afternoon show in Chicago. And you know, this, maybe you've seen my name before and, oh, this media person will sign off on me. And so it was a true division of labor, but Ben's name is first because it is his story. It is his passion project, but the book would not have been able to be made without me becoming attached to it. So that was kind of how we split it up.
I love hearing these stories that you said it, and I don't want to give it away because I want people to read the book, but how you interject the history of the league and how much Division III had an influence on that and focus on certain stories, but also tell the stories of the names. You brought up that stat, 12 of 30. I mean, we are talking about some of the biggest names in basketball. But for those that don't know, tell me some of the names that not only you got to talk to, but write about in this book that started or had experience in Division III. Because we're talking about some of the biggest names in the history of the sport.
Yeah, so I mean, Greg Popovich, for one, you know, he just goes into the Hall of Fame, and at the top of his speech for the Hall of Fame, he said, "How did this happen? I'm a Division III guy." You know, so he starts at Pomona College. He gets in and ends up hiring guys like Sam Presti, probably the best executive in the NBA. When Mike Budenholzer and Frank Vogel are facing off in the NBA Finals, Bucks and Lakers, both former D3 guys, Vogel and Budenholzer. Tom Thibodeau, he's basically done being a coach after Minnesota. He's flamed out in Chicago, flamed out in Minnesota. Gets hired to run the Knicks. They're the 2 seed right now. By Leon Rose, former agent, D3 guy. Tibbs, D3 guy. Brad Stevens, D3 guy. Kobe Altman, who runs the Cavs, D3 guy. Rafael Stone, who runs the Rockets, D3 guy. Going back further, I mean, talk to Mike Fratello and Hubie Brown and Dick Vitale, and talk to Daryl Morey, and stories about guys like Carl Shear and Norm Sanju. And the reason that there's NBA All-Star Saturday in the NBA and a dunk contest in the NBA is because of Carl Shear, who brought it over from the ABA. He's a D3 guy. So the impact on the league is vast, but it's never been more relevant than it is today.
Jeff Van Gundy wrote the foreword for the book, and people that are here in Central New York know this story, but it doesn't hurt to expand it on a little bit. The path that he took, and I've heard you use this line, so I'm going to steal it, Danny. He was the transfer portal before the transfer portal, right? That's normal in college sports today. Jeff Van Gundy had quite a path, and it included some local stops around here. I think people take a lot of pride in that Jeff Van Gundy's got roots here to Central and Western New York and the path that he took.
Yeah, so he's the only person in the history of people to transfer from Yale to Menlo Junior College, right? because he goes to Yale thinking that he's going to play ball. They tell him, "You're not even going to be allowed to try out. You're not good enough." And he loves basketball so much that he's willing to leave Yale and go to Menlo. Then he goes to Brockport, where his dad is the coach. And then they fire his dad. And so he then goes to Nazareth. So it's 4 schools, leaving, starting at Yale, ending at Nazareth. An absolute crazy person, like scouting games on his own, that he, not as a coach, as a player, scouting games that his team is not playing in. Team is deploying a triangle and two against him. He decide, the coach calls timeout, is confused. Jeff takes the whiteboard from him as a player and draws up the offense against the triangle and two. Maybe my favorite Van Gundy story from his days at Nazareth. End of an overtime. There's a technical foul. Zeros on the clock. Technical foul on his team. Shoot free throws, make one, game's over, right? He goes, no, everybody wait. My dad's a coach. I've been in this situation before. The technicals have to be applied at the start of the second overtime. The refs buy it.
Huh.
They play a second overtime. Obviously, that's not how the rules go. Play the second overtime. These refs are reffing the same games or whatever. Week or two later, Nazareth's back in the gym, same refs in the gym. He's like, UMFer, you know how much trouble I got in for blah, 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 blah.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's an absolute crazy person, but a total gem of a human being.
Unbelievable. I love that story. So Van Gundy, I know, appreciated it, wrote the foreword to the book. The names that you're calling, they must have really appreciated that you honed in on this subject. I know the pride that's there. I mean, think about what Division III coaches have to do. They're, you know, they're driving the vans back and forth. They're doing laundry. You guys go over this well in the story. They're not just coaching. You're doing so much more as a Division III coach. But when you're talking to names like this, I'm going to give you an example, Danny. I talked to Donovan McNabb the other day on this very podcast, and going into that interview, I'm like, what the hell did he ask Donovan McNabb that he hasn't already talked about, right? You're trying to find something that you can connect on. How is that challenge for you? But also, it must have been a welcome one when you're talking to these names and you get to discuss something that maybe they've never talked about before.
Yeah, it was, with the exception of the crazy secretive, which is like an ethos of the Greg Popovich worlds, which he's passed down to Sam Presti. So we had to do a lot more digging on those guys and find stuff that they had said 20, 30 years ago. We had over 100 back and forths with the Thunder about getting Presti, and because he's super proud of it, but he won't talk. And so we had to talk to people who had worked with them and people on the coaching staff, the academic advisor at Pomona. You know what I mean? We went very deep.
Yeah.
On these subjects. But for the most part, it was pretty easy to get the interview because of what you're talking about. I'm like, I'm not looking for state secrets on the Cleveland Cavaliers. I want to talk to Kobe Altman about how being a real estate broker after playing at Middlebury helped him negotiate contracts and relate to Dan Gilbert, who made his money in mortgages, you know? And so you're talking to these people about a well-rounded education and their origin story. We're so interested on NFL drafts coming up. We're so interested on the background of these players, but everybody loves being a GM or, you know, thinks that they could be a coach or an offensive coordinator or whatever. These guys also have pretty incredible origin stories. And when the coach is the former player, it's like, oh, okay, I know. He was a player. He got in the door because he was a player. But when it's a guy who looks like Stan Van Gundy, you're like, how the hell did he do that? and these guys were pretty proud to tell their stories.
It's a great book. Everybody should check it out. Of course, Amazon, all the regular places that you can get it. Pipeline of the Pros, Ben Kaplan, Danny Parkins. So that's the book, Danny. There's a couple other things I wanted to talk to you about here. You're in Chicago. Number one pick. Everyone's locked in on Caleb Williams here in this quarterback desert that Chicago has been over the years. Let me just start there. Why is Caleb Williams the guy and not Jaden Daniels or Drake May or some of these other names that are going to go pretty high in this upcoming draft?
I think Caleb is a rare combination of playmaker, and he has an ability to make chicken salad out of chicken bleep with ease in a way that guys like Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes can. And that's the most valuable commodity at this point in football. I mean, he had 8 losses at USC. His defense gave up at least 34 points in all 8 losses. They allowed an average of 43 points per game in the losses. So it wasn't on him. The down year this year was 30 plus touchdowns and 5 interceptions with 3,600 passing yards. He's a Heisman Trophy winner. He has a 46-1 touchdown to interception ratio in the red zone his last 2 years. He hasn't thrown an interception on third or fourth down in the last 2 years on 199 pass attempts. He is an elite level playmaker who doesn't put the ball at risk through the air. He's got a fumbling issue because he holds the ball too long because he's always trying to make the hero play. But the idea is you come into the NFL and you don't always have to make the hero play. He should still have that ability to be a killer as a playmaker. And prospects at his level, they don't bust. They maybe underperform, but they don't bust. It's just a question of degree of success. And Trevor Lawrence, Joe Burrow, Andrew Luck, the guys who we say, oh, he's that caliber of prospect, they all went to either 1 or 2 win teams. Caleb Williams is going to a 7-win team with a top 5 defense that added Keenan Allen, that has the 9th pick in the draft, that added DeAndre Swift, that added Gerald Everett. We've never seen a number 1 pick quarterback go into a situation as good as this. We've seen guys have a ton of success early. C.J. Stroud has had a ton of success early, number 2 pick. Justin Herbert, 31 touchdowns, 10 interceptions, but the 6th overall pick. We've never seen a number 1 pick quarterback go to a situation this good. So because of all of those factors, I think it's a pretty obvious decision.
Danny, as a Buffalo Bills fan, trust me, I've seen the long, winding road between quarterbacks with a ton of potholes in between from Jim Kelly to Josh Allen. So I get it in a way. But it is fascinating to look at Chicago and say, how in the world can that proud franchise be such a quarterback desert? I brought it up with McNabb the other day. I said, you're a quarterback from Chicago. How does this happen, right? So I turn that over to you. How have the Chicago Bears been this quarterback desert pretty much their entire existence. It's incredible to look at.
Yeah, I mean, I remove pretty much. They're the only franchise in NFL history to never have a 4,000-yard passer.
Wow.
They're the only franchise in NFL history to never have a 30-touchdown passer. 30.
That's incredible.
Every other team has at least one of both of those guys. Bears have never had either. So part of it is their history and the team, like the teams that formed the identity of the Chicago Bears. Gale Sayers and Dick Butkus are in the same draft class in the early 60s. Never play in a playoff game together, but iconic figures, right? Then the 85 Bears, everybody knows. Walter Payton and the greatest defense of all time, the last Bears Super Bowl champion. So for a huge portion of their history, it's run the ball, play defense, run the ball, play defense. Oh, it's the Windy City. The stadium's on the lakefront. You can't throw the ball. That's ridiculous. You could throw the ball in Lambeau Field. You could throw the ball in Buffalo, but you can't throw the ball in Chicago. So for 50 years, 40 years, it was about identity. And then there's been some bad luck, man. Like Jay Cutler, crazy talented, but didn't work hard enough to improve. He was making the same mistakes in year 9 that he was making in year 3. Mitch Trubisky, they thought, Mahomes, Trubisky, Mahomes, Trubisky, Mahomes, Trubisky. They settled on Trubisky. Mistake. Justin Fields, crazy talented, didn't do anything to surround him, and he didn't improve enough as a passer fast enough. You know, Cade McNown, a bust. Rex Grossman makes it to a Super Bowl, has a nice moment or two. But, I mean, in my lifetime, I'm 37 years old. I don't remember. I was not born. I'm born in 86. The debate for best Bears quarterback in my lifetime is Justin Fields, Eric Kramer, Jay Cutler.
Ooh.
That's the debate. And so the bar that Caleb has to clear is an incredibly low one.
And, of course, the big name is Jim McMahon, but Jim McMahon had a couple nice years, don't get me wrong, but who would look at that 85 Bears team or any of those teams and say he was the reason they were that team?
Yeah, he's the funky QB. He was an icon. He had the headband. He was in the commercials. But, I mean, Gary Fensick, Richard Dent, Mongo McMichael, Dan Hampton, Mike Singletary, Otis Wilson, Walter Payton. You know what I mean? You're mentioning a ton of guys in terms of who was better at their job before you would get to Jim McMahon. And again, I was born in 86. That was 85. So I'm talking modern Bears history. Post-85 Bears, that's the list of quarterbacks.
That's incredible to think about. Danny, we could write a book on your time in Syracuse. Trust me. There's a lot of stories there. And I just think back to when you were here and we got to work together, of course, and you went to Syracuse University, and there's some great stories there. I mean, I could pick a number here, but take me back to your time here, not only in going to Newhouse and going through that process, and you know, you were there at the same time as Nick Wright and Andrew Filippone, who are now, you know, Nick Wright, of course, is on Fox Sports and is one of the most successful sports voices out there today. Pony is in Pittsburgh and has made a lot of success there. And there's always a lot of talent, right? We hear about WAER and WJPZ and Syracuse and Newhouse. But you had to go through some interesting things when you were here at Syracuse. And I'll just say this. You made a lot of trips to the Turning Stone Casino when you were here. And we'll kind of take it from there.
Yeah, man. I mean, what you just alluded to, I feel like everybody in Syracuse knows the story of WAER. Mm-hmm. And that's why you go to that university if you can. It's not really for the classes. It's for the competition and the networking and a student radio station with cuts. And, I mean, Nick just had his vow renewals in Kansas City this weekend. I'm the best man. Pony and Mike Meltzer are there, you know what I mean? And so those four guys. But in that room, it was Adam Lefko and Mike Cousins and Andy McCullough and Zach Berman and Zach Gelb and Connor Orr. And like, they're all like, so some are writers, some are TV guys, some are play-by-play guys, some are talk show hosts, but like, that's a lot of media acumen and talent in a room, but everyone like knows that story, man. I graduated in 2009, the housing crisis of 2008, advertising freezes across the industry, nobody hiring. I am parlaying the poker skills that I learned at Turning Stone and living like a degenerate by Wrigley Field with four of my friends, basically just, I mean, smoking pot, waking up at 11, getting a burrito, going to the casino, coming home, maybe selling a parking spot for a Cubs game, like smoking more pot, going out, waking up, going to the casino. And I came back to Syracuse to watch a Syracuse basketball game. You and I had brunch or breakfast or whatever. And I was like, I still don't have a gig. And you said, well, they're looking to expand local programming between Bud and the Manchild and On the Block. Would you be interested? And I was like, hell yeah, I'd be interested. And you said, okay, well, I can make the introduction, but the catch is there's no money. It's $9 an hour.
That's right. Yeah.
I was like, well, okay. I'd been making money playing cards. You know what I mean? So I was like, there's Turning Stone. Poker money was drying out. I remember my big negotiating win was instead of them paying me 4 hours a day, two to produce Bud and the Manchild and two to host my show, they'd pay me 6 hours a day. So I was like, you got to prep the show. I lived with two random dudes from Craigslist, made $54 a day. And it launched my professional career because I didn't have any new tape, right? I mean, my stuff was like 10 months old at that point. The internet hadn't completely taken off in terms of the ease of podcasting, and I needed a job. And so I'm forever grateful to you, man. I mean, I know I ended up getting fired from producing Bud and the Manchild because I criticized their Syracuse football takes on the air, which was a mistake in hindsight. But it freed me up as long as they didn't fire me from hosting the show. I know I caused some headaches for you along the way. But you've always been a huge advocate for me and honestly, like one of the most pivotal people in my career, because who knows how long it would have taken me to get that first job. And what I tell kids all the time is like the first professional job is the hardest one to get and the most important, not because it's got to be the biggest or best job, but it's really hard to convince someone to hire you off of college stuff. It's really hard to do. Maybe it's getting easier because everybody has a podcast and the internet. And like, if you're really good, it'll cut through. So maybe there's not as much of a stigma on it today as there was, but there used to be quite a stigma to hire someone out of that first gig. And so I'm forever indebted to you, buddy.
I appreciate you saying that, but there was a couple things that stood out to me and you mentioned it. This is not a time where there's 1,000 podcasts out there. And I think it's actually harder to break through these days, even with social media and everything. I heard something in you. I saw something in you. I saw the work ethic. And the interesting thing was, so it was between you and Kevin Marr. And Kevin Marr was an established WTVH5 television personality here. Would have been a name people would know right away. But I just saw something in you, and it didn't work out with Kevin. And I had to really pitch and strongly advocate for you behind the scenes. And I just kept saying how worth it would be. Like you said, ruffle some feathers, get fired from the producing gig. You know, there were some things that happened behind the scenes that I had some conversations with management about. And Danny, I don't think I've ever told you this. What I kept telling them eventually was, look, you need to put up with this because he's not going to be here that long. This kid's going to a bigger market. So just deal with the headache now because he's going to be out of here soon because this kid's going somewhere, right? And I was proven right on that. So thank you for proving me right on that.
And yeah.
The headaches worth it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think I've become a much better, you know what I mean? I was 23. You know what I mean? I was dumb. I didn't know what I didn't know. I was just like, all I cared about was the 2 hours of the airtime and then doing whatever I could to, you know what I mean? So I was not playing politics or an office favorite. And to your credit, to your point, I was also not trying to stick around that long. Like yeah. I was a little embarrassed as the top guy at AER in my class to be back in Syracuse. I love Syracuse, but I always wanted it to be where I went to college. I didn't want it to be where I lived after college. Like it was just like a little embarrassing going back in that April and the class below me is getting ready to graduate. And there's nothing wrong with working in Syracuse. I love it. It's an unbelievable sports market. It just wasn't how I saw my thing going. And so I just had like a chip on my shoulder and had my tail between my legs at the same time. So that led to insecurities. And I just tried to funnel it all into the takes and the 2 hour a day show. And so I was definitely rough around the edges in some other areas, but
the thing
you
is,
you were huge, man. Thank you.
You're welcome, and I appreciate that. But you put in the work. You did it. You created a show. And what stands out to me this day, Danny, is I still have people that when I bring up your name or somehow some way it comes up, you connected with an audience in a way that I don't think I have seen, particularly a host of your age do. Like I've been here my whole life. I was there when Pearl Washington hit that half court shot, when Michael Owens took it into the corner of the end zone. Like I have that rapport with our audience. For you as a 23-year-old kid from Chicago to connect with a Syracuse audience the way that you did, how did you do that?
So that is actually really interesting. It's probably the most valuable lesson I took from Syracuse, from working in Syracuse, not Syracuse University, from that year or 10 months or whatever it was that I was at the Score 1260 with you. I just believe in local radio. Like people, it seemed to me that there was, and you had 4 hours, so it was a little different. But it seemed to me that like, well, we'll just do a national take, or we'll just talk about the Yankees. I was like, I can do 2 hours a day on Syracuse football and Syracuse basketball. That was my thing. I was like, I am going to go to Jim Boeheim's open practices. I am going to go to Syracuse football spring practice. I am going to bring my recorder and interview the players. I was about their age. Hell, I'd been drinking with some of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I knew where they went out. I was like, I am going to do 2 hours a day. I mean, I remember doing a segment about that did not make people at the university terribly happy, about like the attractive stats girl that would walk around. I was like, I know that everybody in the dome will know who I'm talking about. Like, you know what I mean? And I probably should not have done that. It was immature and stupid. But again, I was 23 years old. But you know what I mean? Like, I was like, I am going to do a hyper localized, oh, the halftime show was funny at the Syracuse basketball game the night before. Well, 28,000 people were there. So I can talk about that and assume that a decent number of them will be in my listening audience. And so I didn't do Syracuse Crunch. I didn't do Syracuse Chiefs. I didn't do Yankees. I didn't do Bills. I did Syracuse basketball, Syracuse football, and what it was like to live in Syracuse, New York as a 23-year-old. That's what I did. And I think that people appreciated that. And that was probably why I connected. I mean, I was going to people's tailgates that were listeners. You know what I mean?
I remember that.
I was interacting on the message board. Like, I just tried to be whoever the most diehard Syracuse basketball and football fans were. I wanted to make the radio show for them. And that was kind of my... And so when I went to Kansas City, even though I thought, okay, I'm going to end up in Miami or Cleveland or Detroit before I ultimately get to Chicago, I was like, I'm going to get a Missouri driver's license. I'm going to get a dentist in Kansas City. I'm going to go to the Royals games. I'm going to go to the Chiefs games. I got to go to Allen Fieldhouse. I got to go to a game in Manhattan, Kansas for K-State. I got to go to Columbia to go to a Mizzou game. Like, I've got to be here. And then I ended up staying in Kansas City for over 6 years because I met my girlfriend who became my wife, and they kept promoting me, and the city was great. But that lesson of, like, do a local show and don't make people feel like you're just stopping over. Like, you knew that I thought I was just stopping over in Syracuse, but I don't think the audience, maybe they thought it because I was good or my talent or whatever, but I don't think that I made it seem to the audience that I was like looking to leave. I did a Syracuse show for people in Syracuse. That was how I approached it.
Well said, my friend. Well, I am so incredibly proud of you, not only for what you've done in life in terms of your profession and writing this book, but being a father and the things that you have endured the past couple of years and how you've handled that and how you're giving back to that now. So look, just congratulations on everything and what you're doing in life and in your profession. It's great to see. It's great to catch up. We'll definitely do it again soon, but thanks for coming on and sharing your story with us. And the book's doing well. People can get it, like you said, at Amazon, all the usual places. And if you are a smidge of a basketball fan, read this book. You will love it. You will enjoy it.
Axe, thank you, man. You're the best. Always indebted to you. Thank you for having me on.